This could be if it's, let's say, a Medicare patient, right? You may have an FBI agent that comes and shows up at your office. You may have a contact from HHS or, or CMS, right, from Medicare that says, hey, we want these records. Or you may have an agent that just shows up at your office.
That's healthcare attorney Matthew J. Levy, and this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, bringing healthcare innovators and experts together. Matthew Levy is shareholder director of Weiss, Zarrett, Brofman, Sonnenklar, and Levy PC, and chairs the firm's corporate transaction and healthcare regulatory practice. Matt, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, Teresa, thank you very much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here, and we're looking forward to talking with you.
So I wanted to start with something that you published about a week or so ago about the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, our friends at CMS. They're temporarily pausing Medicare payments to providers until, I guess, this month, later this month, when Congress is expected to pass a sequester fix. What does that mean for providers?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is a little bit complicated. So I'm really going to really try to clarify this and put this in layman's terms so everyone can really truly understand what's going on. And in order to do that, I just want to give a little bit of background. So Medicare actually has two cuts prepared for providers within 2021 and 2022. The first cut was supposed to be a 2% cut, which came to an equivalent of approximately $18 billion. The second cut, which is coming and is currently scheduled for January 1 of 2022, is for 4%. And that's an equivalent of approximately $36 billion. So if you think about it as a provider, you're really looking at a 6% cut coming your way. And you really do need to start preparing and thinking about, you know, what that means to your practice. You know, we represent hundreds of practices and, you know, the margins over the years, their profit margin has decreased significantly as, you know, the cost of reimbursement, well, the cost of running the practice has, you know, exponentially gone up, and the reimbursements, as you can see here, are starting to go down. So due to the pandemic, the CARES Act has suspended the first cut of 2%, and initially it suspended the 2% reduction from a period of May 1st of 2020 through December 31st of 2020. So in theory, the cuts would actually be in effect now. Then the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021 extended that suspension of the 2% reduction through March 31st of 2021. As we sit here today, we're in April. So luckily, the legislature has acted and passed a law on April 14th of 2021, and that has extended the suspension of the 2% cut to December 31st of 2021. So that raises a lot of issues as to, well, what about those claims, the services that I provided, the claims that I've submitted prior to these dates? Where is that money? Because I haven't seen it yet, right? And the MAC, right, the Medicare administrative contractors should automatically be releasing those funds. Teresa, you and I both know that that's, you know, has not happened across the board. And for those providers that have not received those funds, they should be contacting the MAC, or they can contact us. And I know, Teresa, later on we'll give my contact information so that these providers can, in fact, do that. So the key really here is that from January 1, 2022, as things stand today, there's a 6% reduction coming to providers' way. So that takes preparation and planning to be proactive with this, not to be reactive, because, you know, you start reacting to a 6% cut, you know, when it happens, you know, unfortunately, that could put a lot of people out of business. So also, the Medicare Administrative Contractors, also known as the MAC, should have released payment in full to all of the service providers. However, you know, we know that that's not that has not happened for all the providers that we're representing. So you can contact us. We are reaching out to the MAC and handling that for our providers. So if there are providers out there that are listening to this that have either attempted to or just don't want to deal with it and would rather have, you know, a law firm do that, they can contact us directly, and we will be handling that, as we are for many of our clients.
Great. I do have two follow-up questions. Number one, are all providers affected by these cuts, or is it certain, is it like primary care or subspecialists, or is it everybody? And part two is, when were these cuts first enacted? So obviously this all preceded COVID and the financial devastation that that these practices have seen since then.
Right. So from our understanding, this is a, you know, across the board with Medicare. This predates COVID. You know, Medicare has their cuts, pre-planned cuts, right? And this was just part of that process. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, or fortunately, as it relates to the providers in this case, you know, all these cuts have been suspended, you know, and rightfully so, because they'll ensure that, you know, the healthcare providers who have been, you know, literally on the front lines of this pandemic are, you know, supported during this difficult time.
So in your experience and based on your clients, how are providers doing financially? Have they bounced back from the losses they incurred during the pandemic, or are they continuing to struggle a bit?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. And you know, at our firm, you know, we represent, you know, pretty much all we do is represent providers, right? And it runs the full spectrum of all different types of providers, whether they're physicians or nurses or dentists, acupuncturists, physical therapists, yeah, and on. You know, some of them are thriving, others are suffering. I think it's pretty consistent, you know, just with the, you know, demographics of, you know, of our area and, you know, and all businesses. So, you know, as an example, you know, I have some ear, nose and throat physicians that, you know, prior to COVID were absolutely thriving. But, you know, sort of like the good news, bad news, right? The good news is a lot of people weren't getting sick and they didn't have those secondary infections and they didn't have those sinus infections. And you know, these are things that, you know, we don't typically think about, but their business, right, has absolutely taken a nosedive. Others, on the other hand, you know, where they're running, you know, urgent care or primary care, you know, or our lab companies that we represent, they're absolutely thriving.
Yeah. So it really just depends on what niche they fit into and how the pandemic has affected their patient flow.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, surgeries now, you know, it's up and running, open it up. But, you know, during the pandemic, you know, our elective surgery, you know, clients, you know, were really hurting and you know, it really affected them, you know, badly. But now they're okay, you know, now they're opening up and they're back and the ambulatory surgery centers are back up and functioning.
Sure. I'd like to talk for a couple of minutes, if you don't mind, about a topic that you addressed at our Toolkit for Independence event back in March, which is how to deal with an audit. And one of the things that you said that was so startling to probably not just me, but everybody who heard it, was that 72% of providers are committing healthcare fraud. Is that true? And can you give us some background on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of data out there as to, you know, what is going on in the industry from a documentation and coding standpoint. And I know that 72% is a shocking number. But remember that the way that healthcare fraud is defined is different than the way fraud is defined or a crime is defined, you know, in a criminal setting, right? Where intent really is the main focus of that. Well, when it comes to healthcare and it comes to billing and submitting claims to the insurance company, and even more specifically to a federally funded program like Medicare or Medicaid, you know, the definition of, you know, fraud is pretty loosely described, right? So there could just be an abusive billing pattern, right? And that will be deemed as fraud. So, you know, we have providers that, you know, look, we still have providers today that don't even have electronic medical records, you know, and they're still doing things the same way they were doing it decades ago. And you and I both know that not only has the coding changed annually, It is just drastically changed. Not only that, you know, we've gone from, you know, CPT codes to ICD-10 codes. And so merely billing things the same way that you always build them, just because that's the way you build them, you don't think you're doing anything wrong. I mean, in other words, that provider really truly doesn't have any intent to defraud the system. Unfortunately, though, those codes have changed so dramatically, you know, in the last decade, and not to mention the last couple of years, that, you know, yeah, they're falling into that area. Other areas that, you know, get you to that 72% number, you know, you could have providers that actually, you know, are aware of the current ICD-10 codes, but they're providing services and billing services, you know, that, yeah, had they been educated properly, are what we call a bundled code, right? That, you know, the service that they're providing and the additional test that they're providing actually falls under one particular code. But what they're doing is they're billing it out under two separate codes. That's actually called unbundling codes. It's actually a higher rate of reimbursement, and the government sees that as fraud as well. So again, they may not be doing it intentionally, and there are some that are doing that intentionally, but there are many that aren't. And again, that will fall into that category of that 72%. There's a lot of other factors as well, and whether it's, you know, there could be upcoding, and, you know, where someone might think that, you know, something might be a level 3 visit. And let's just, you know, sort of set a hypothetical here. Let's just say, for just the ease of conversation, there are different levels of codes, a level 1 through a level 5, a level 1 being the most basic service you would perform, also the lowest rate of reimbursement, versus a level 5 visit would be the most acute type of visit and the highest rate of reimbursement. And what providers don't realize is that, unlike the past or a generation ago, where they treated patients and they, you know, would bill the insurance company by snail mail, today, you know, the providers are billing electronically, and the insurance companies have invested a significant amount of money into their software and have set up billing algorithms that are able to capture and compare how that provider bills year to date compared to themselves, as well as how they can bill compared to their colleagues in the same subspecialty in the same region. So now, we have billing algorithms that are set up to capture, you know, how physicians are billing. And if they're billing a certain code too high, right, and that's going to be the upcoding, or if they're billing a code just too often. And by the way, it doesn't mean it's too often that they did anything wrong. It's just what we'll call a bell curve that the insurance companies have unilaterally set up and have, you know, determined, hey, if you bill this code more than X amount of times, our computer system is going to spit you out, define you as an outlier, and we're going to audit you, right? So these are various ways that audits get started, and how you get to that 72% number, you know, there's a whole, you know, list of ways, you know, that you get there.
And you are such an expert on this, and I want to come back and talk about this some more, but we are going to take a very brief break first, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with healthcare attorney Matthew Levy, and we're talking about payer audits. So I know that you're an advocate for practices hiring coding specialists. What's the benefit of doing so?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the solutions to avoiding the, what we'll call the prepayment review audit or the post-payment review audit, is to have your documentation and your coding in order, right, to be compliant. And one way of doing that at a relatively inexpensive rate is to actually hire a certified coder. And I'm not necessarily saying that you should do that as a full-time employee. Quite frankly, I'm suggesting that you not do that. You should probably retain the certified coder through a law firm and then have what's called a covel agreement. And the reason for that is an attorney and a client have what's called an attorney-client privilege. And that all of those communications and all of those findings, right, are protected. And what you don't want to do is have a contractor, like an accountant or a certified coder, hired directly by the practice, because whatever conversations and information that is found or determined, or discussions, emails and texts, are all discoverable. And so you want to avoid that. So I don't think that it should be a W-2 employment relationship. I think that it should be hired through a law firm with a co-vel arrangement, and there'll be what we call a snapshot review. At our firm, we actually provide a free snapshot review of like 5 charts with a certified coder to review and analyze the documentation and coding. And if you get a good, clean bill of health, God bless. If you don't, hey, you have the option to get full training and education from a certified coder to train you and your entire staff.
Yeah, that's a great way to be proactive, right? To avoid the potential of having that awful experience, I'm sure, of having the practice audited. So what is the typical scenario when there is an audit? Does somebody knock on the door? Do you get a letter? Do you get a phone call? How does that typically happen?
That's a great question, Teresa. And I don't want to sound like a lawyer and say it depends, right? But it does, right? So if it's a routine audit, right, you'll get a letter. You know, you'll get a letter that will say, hey, you know, Dr. Dex, we'd like to see these 10 charts. And the first part of that analysis has to be, first of all, am I obligated to submit those charts to the insurance company or not? And the first analysis, part of that analysis is, am I an in-network provider or an out-of-network provider? If you're an in-network provider, you've signed a contract that actually obligates you to submit those records to them. The second part of that analysis is whether or not I have a HIPAA violation in the event that I submit those records to the insurance company or not. Well, if you've signed that provider agreement, there is an exclusion to the HIPAA rule. And so it is not a HIPAA violation for you to submit those records to the insurance company without the written authorization of each patient.
And will they request specific records, or is it a random sampling of charts?
Every investigation is different, right? So, and it depends on how that investigation got to the insurance company. So we may have an investigation that got to the insurance company as a result of a disgruntled employee, or we may have gotten to the insurance company as a result of a disgruntled patient, right? We call those whistleblower cases. And those investigations are typically going to be really fine-tuned, right? A specific scenario, a specific code. So yeah, first of all, they'll ask for the records of those particular patients or patient that, you know, brought the investigation about. But they'll look for the services and along the lines of the complaint and look to see who else that particular provider billed that way. And then, or typically, the third way that most audits come about is these billing algorithms that we had previously discussed. Those will be pretty much random. You'll get a letter, just randomly, here's 10 names, please send us those charts. Now, when you get a request for 100 or 200 or 300 charts, that's no longer a routine audit. That is a significant, you know, audit. And remember, anytime you're getting this, the practice is under investigation. So you can't take these things lightly. But when you get to, you know, something more than 20, 30 charts, you really do need to, you know, really think about, you know, this is a lot more serious than just a routine billing algorithm that just spits you out.
Are we only talking about insurance companies doing these audits, or could this be a government agency, a government payer as well?
It's both, right? So in the whistleblower case, right, where we have a disgruntled patient or disgruntled employee, they may go to the insurance company, they may go to the government, right? So this could be, if it's, let's say, a Medicare patient, right? You may have an FBI agent that comes and shows up at your office. You may have a contact from HHS or, or CMS, right? From Medicare that says, hey, we want these records. Or you may have an agent that just shows up at your office. So one thing that you want to be careful of and you want to train your staff is how to handle that situation. And again, you know, you have to be careful about this because you don't want to alarm, you know, your staff, like, you know, we're under investigation. No, what you want to do is educate and train your staff like, hey, look, this is what's going on in the industry. In the event that this should happen, and we're not under investigation, but in the event that someone should come in here, here is the policy and procedure for this practice. And by the way, Teresa, anyone that, you know, members of your podcast that sign up, you know, they can contact me directly and we will provide to them a free corporate policy related to how to handle an investigator if they show up at your office. So just getting back on point to what we were talking about before. So if and when that, you know, agent shows up at that practice or your home, the first thing is you need to identify who this person is. How do you know they are who they purport to be? And typically, they're going to be asking for PHI, right? Protected health information, which you cannot under any circumstances just go and turn over to anyone. Nor should you be turning it over to a federal agent or to a, you know, it could be the, you know, the attorney general's office. So if it's a state investigation or it's the U.S. attorney's office, if it's a federal investigation, the first thing you want to do is identify who they are. And then we want to be able to confirm, right, who they are. So we're going to call them back. No matter what, at that moment in time, that is not a good time for you to talk with them. You'll have their name. You'll have their number. If they have a badge, we want their badge number as well. And then contact your attorney. Have your attorney reach out to them and handle it from there. Once your attorney has made contact with them, they should no longer have access to you directly. And all communications should go through the attorney. So if you're in New York, you know, in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, DC or Florida, we'd be happy to help you out. We have, you know, attorneys in our office that are, you know, licensed in those various states. To the extent that you're out of those states, you should, you know, you can contact that state bar association's, you know, organization, the state bar association, and request a, you know, an attorney that handles this type of work within that particular state. Once that investigator comes in, and they're communicated with, right, they're going to probably request some records. The attorney will go through the process of making sure, you know, that it's HIPAA compliant. Again, they may ask for 500 records. That's an overwhelming amount of records and can take an extraordinary amount of time to get that. Typically, we work that out to a reasonable number, provide those records to them, and then the investigation will take its course from there, depending on what the issues are. So that's, you know, when it is really like a whistleblower type of scenario, you'll receive contact from a state or federal agency. You could also, you know, receive contact from DOH, the Department of Health, and that's who has jurisdiction over the physician or healthcare, you know, well, physician and physician assistants licenses. On the other hand, if this is a chiropractor or an acupuncturist or any other healthcare provider, they might hear from the Office of Professional Discipline. That's through the Department of Education. So they have jurisdiction over all other healthcare providers. We handle all of those types of investigations.
Okay. And can the practice reasonably continue to function during an audit of that magnitude?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're, and again, case by case scenario, right? So, you know, if we have a, and again, we're going to assume that no one listening to this is doing what I'm about to say, right? You know, if you have a practice that's billing hypothetically, let's say for dead patients, right? That's not something that's really going to be defendable, right? And if that's what your policy is and that's what you're doing, you're going to jail. On the other hand, if we go back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, we're billing a certain way just because, you know, we're billing that way because that's all we know. Yeah, you know, we're going to have a certified coder part of this process who's going to review and analyze, you know, your documentation, your coding. And by the way, just because the insurance company says you did something wrong doesn't mean you did. All right. We're going to look at the local coverage determination. We're going to look at the Medicare guidelines and we're going to see if what you've done is appropriate. And also, if they've gone back a bunch of years, we're going to make sure that the Medicare guidelines at that particular time, right, is the, you know, the, you know, that you were compliant with those regs at that time, not being held to the standard of what's in place today.
Right.
There are lots of different things that we find when we go through these audits and we, and ultimately the clients wind up having to pay nothing. Obviously we're not guaranteeing anything right now, but those are some scenarios where we have been able to completely, we've had $16 million right, in one audit, and the client wound up paying $1,400. And to be fair, they shouldn't have even had to pay the $1,400. It just wasn't worth the legal fees to fight it any further.
Right. So a lot of forensic work involved in all of that.
Agreed.
One thing that you mentioned that I thought was very interesting was that even lease agreements can get a practice in hot water. Can you tell us how that is an area that they need to be concerned about?
Absolutely. So this requires a little bit of a foundation to be established first. And this applies across the board, but very much so in the no-fault and workers' comp areas, opposed to what we've been talking about so far. And when I say that, meaning that's where I find this to be prevalent, it applies across the board, period. So what we have to talk about, one, is the prohibition of against the corporate practice of medicine, right? And in New York, we have that. And in short, what that means is that an unlicensed individual can't control or own a medical practice, right? And those individuals that have different licenses, such as like a doctor and a dentist, they can't be partners in the same business. And I just give that as a background so we can talk about what we're going to be talking about next. So we have the prohibition against the corporate practice of medicine, and then we also have the anti-kickback statute. And the anti-kickback statute, in essence, basically says that you can't pay for the referral of of patients, right? I mean, there can't be the exchange of any remuneration. I mean, we can get into the exact language, but just to keep this in layman terms for our discussion, you can't pay for patients, period. All right. So what the government looks at is these practices that are leasing out space to various other healthcare providers. So for example, you could have a chiropractor, and I'm not looking to pick on them, but just you may have a chiropractor that has an office space, and they may lease out the space to a physical therapist, an acupuncturist, massage therapist, right? They may even lease it out, to a physician also. Remember, they're leasing it out. They're not partners. So now what happens is those arrangements where the chiropractor has his office or her office, and they might be referring their patients to these tenants, right, for various services, physical therapy, acupuncture, medical practice services, like our hypothetical. Well, let's just say, that office is located in Nassau County, and the going rate for square footage is, let's say, $35 a square foot. Well, if the tenants are paying $60 a square foot, the government is saying, whoa, that's not right. That's not an arm's length transaction. That's not fair market value, right? The reason, landlord, chiropractor, you're charging the medical doctor $60 a square foot is because you're referring patients to him, and that's how you're getting payment back for those referrals. So that's how the government, as well as the insurance companies, the no-fault insurance companies, they issue these EUOs, examinations under oath, constantly to providers, right? And one of the things that they're looking at is not necessarily the claims that you've submitted, but what your corporate structure is. And if you have this corporate structure, well, the government deems it to be what they call, in quotes, a suspect arrangement. And a suspect arrangement does have a complete defense as long as you satisfy all of the elements. What are those elements? One, there must be a lease in writing. It must be set forth for a minimum period of 12 months. The rate must be a fixed, flat, fair market value rate. And that contract cannot be terminated and renegotiated until a 12-month period of time has expired. Now, the reason for all of that is the government is saying, hey, if you guys are going to be in this, what we call a suspect arrangement, there must be risk on both sides. And the risk is you're going to be paying rent whether you get zero patients or you get 1,000 patients. So when these arrangements are on a percentage basis, that's what's deemed illegal as well, because they're saying there's no risk involved, right? If there's no patients, you're not paying rent. If there's a lot of patients, you're paying more rent. And there's two things that these arrangements cannot be based upon at any time. It cannot be based upon the volume of patients or the amount of revenue that is generated from the professional services that are rendered, period. All right. So that's why how the anti-kickback statute gets, connected to this.
so many things for providers to think about, to worry about, and so many areas where they face potential exposure and they really need to have somebody like you looking out for them and making sure that they stay on the right side of laws and regulations. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential. Matt Levy, can you tell our listeners how they can learn more about you and get in touch with you?
Absolutely. And again, it does seem overwhelming when you look at everything, but the way that we look at this and the way that we handle our clients, you know, is really providing solutions. You know, we're not here to, you know, be judgmental or to scare them. You know, there are solutions. Let's attack it together, get through it, be proactive so that you don't have to deal with this stuff going forward and you can sleep at night. Sure. The way that you can contact me, my direct line is area code 516-926-3320. Or you can email me at MLEVSZART@weissart.com.
Great. And is there a website they can visit as well?
Yes, you can go to our website, which is weissart.com. That's weissart.com.
Great. Thank you so much for that. I want to also remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available every Monday morning, wherever you access podcasts. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by Patrick Karsik. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.